This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Richard, it is truly amazing to think of the massive global historical impact that happened under the LBJ administration, under the Nixon administration, and, you know, tell us about these points in history, 1968, 1971, and then you said in the 80s, you know, early 80s or about 1980, I think. Give us the synopsis of those, if you would.
Well, it is a fascinating story. So President Johnson in the 60s spent too much money on domestic welfare programs. At the same time, he was spending too much money on the Vietnam War.
And that
overstimulated the U.S. economy. And at that time, we were still on the Bretton Woods system. And so at that time, the U.S., as hard as it is to believe now, the U.S. did not have a trade deficit. No country did. No country could under the Bretton Woods system. And so we suddenly, all of that too much government spending started to lead to high rates of inflation. And also, all of the government spending sent a lot of dollars overseas. For instance, the spending in Vietnam, that caused a lot of dollars to go overseas. And also, U.S. corporations and banks were investing a lot in Europe. So a lot of dollars went overseas for those reasons. Now, at that time, other countries had the right to take the dollars that they accumulated and convert them into U.S. gold at $35 an ounce. So during the 1960s, for those reasons, the U.S. lost half of its gold reserves. And at that time, there was a law that required the Fed to maintain 25% gold backing for every dollar that it issued. Well, by 1968, it hit that limit. It didn't have enough gold to continue backing the dollars. And so at that point, Lyndon Johnson asked Congress to remove the requirement that the Fed maintain any gold backing for the dollar whatsoever. And Congress complied, and afterwards the dollars no longer had any gold backing.
Right. And then in 71, what did Nixon do?
So this situation continued under Nixon. He should have put his foot on the brake on the economy and slowed the economy down so that the U.S. trade deficit would become less severe, and so less dollars would leave the country. But he did just the opposite, so he would be reelected.
That's what they all do.
That's what they do. And so that stimulated the economy even more and led to even a larger trade deficit and more dollars going overseas. So by 1971, there were far more dollars overseas than the United States had gold available to convert them into. And so at that point, Nixon reneged on the U.S. pledge at Bretton Woods to allow other countries to exchange their dollars for gold in August 1971. And afterwards, there was no gold backing whatsoever. That was the end of the Bretton Woods system. And afterwards, suddenly we had a very big surge in the amount of paper money being created. This led to the high rates of inflation in the 1970s. We had double-digit inflation in the 70s. And Paul Volcker had to crush that, Fed Chairman Volcker.
And that he did. So Volcker was like a real guy. I mean, take the medicine, but he fixed the problem. But Richard, I got to ask you something. Indulge me in this little conspiracy theory for a moment. So I wonder many times if Nixon, because of what he did, maybe he felt guilty and knew it would be a huge problem, closing the gold window. And, you know, his historic trip to China, was Nixon thinking this is a new labor market, a cheaper labor market that would allow us to get it took a while for it to happen. Certainly didn't happen under him, obviously. But, you know, to bring in all kinds of cheap goods and hide the ravages of inflation that he knew was coming. Because remember, he was the guy that did price controls and we had gas lines. And I mean, that was a pretty crazy time under Nixon, you know.
Tricky Dick was pretty clever, especially with Kissinger at his side. But and of course, that may be true, what you suggest, but I think that was premature. I don't think anyone could have foreseen that occurring. Remember, it hadn't been that many years earlier that Chairman Mao had urged the Soviet Union to have a nuclear war with the U.S. because he believed China could survive it and no one else would. They were very much a Cold War enemy at that point. Chairman Mao was still in the office. So I don't think that was the reason at that time. But eventually, of course, that's the way things evolved. And so once Chairman Volcker crushed inflation, we had a very severe, he hiked the federal funds rate up into the very high double digits or 20% or so. That caused a very severe recession in the early 80s. Unemployment went to 10%. It was one of the worst recessions we had seen in the century. And then President Reagan was elected. And the next year, the U.S., he started doing exactly what President Johnson and President Nixon had done. He started running very large budget deficits. In fact, his budget deficits were far, far larger than the other presidents up until that time.
Yeah, I give Reagan a bit of a pass on that because I think that was a business plan with the, you know, Soviet Union to win the Cold War. But maybe you don't. I don't know. Feel free to disagree. But
well, the reason, so you would have thought that spending by the government on such a massive scale would have once again led to higher rates of inflation as it did under Johnson and Nixon, but it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because starting in 1981, the U.S. started buying things from other countries and running massive trade deficits. By the mid-80s, the U.S. trade deficit was 3.5% of GDP. And of course, by 2006, it was 6% of GDP. That in 2006, it was $800 billion. And those trade deficits changed the U.S. economy from being a relatively closed domestic economy concerned about domestic bottlenecks. Suddenly, we had a global economy. And in our global economy today, 2 billion people live on less than $3 a day. So this changed everything. So now they're...
But compared to what? I mean, didn't they live on less before? I mean, look at how urbanized China has become. Now, you could certainly argue that living in smog-filled cities is not as good as living in the country, you know, eating your daughters. But, and by the way, that's actually true. So pretty disgusting, but yeah.
Well, my point is that because of globalization, beginning in the early 1980s, the massive budget deficits that President Reagan ran didn't cause inflation. And in fact, we started seeing inflation rates kept moving lower and lower and lower, and interest rates kept going lower and lower and lower.
Because, of course, we're importing all these cheap consumer goods.
Exactly. Yeah. And that pushed down wage rates in the U.S., and that's caused the wage rates to stagnate for practically 30 years now in the U.S., but it also allowed interest rates to come down and this property prices to move way, way up and the stock prices to move up. And so that changed everything. Once we moved from a gold-backed monetary system that didn't allow trade deficits to this paper-backed monetary system that allows massive trade deficits, then this has created a completely different economic environment that with new rules. And the new rules are there's really very little limit as to how much the government can borrow and how much paper money the Fed can print and use to finance the government budget deficits as long as this system of globalization continues to keep a lid on interest rates.
You are absolutely right. And so, I, you know, just looking back on all of this stuff, it seems like the U.S. got the better end of that deal all the way around. I mean, look at the massive amount of material, I don't want to say wealth, but consumption in the U.S. compared to these other countries. Now, I think it's globalization has made it better for, you know, 300 million people around the world, at least economically. You know, we can argue sweatshops all you want and all that, and you know, that's arguable for sure, but you know, I mean, the U.S. has just been the beneficiary of this. The only problem has been the stagnating wages. But heck, you go shopping and everything's cheap. And that inflation has been hidden. And I think that's why they don't want to control the southern border, because just as you import cheap goods from China, you import cheap labor from Mexico. And you can paper over the problem by just ultimately printing money. And there's no limit to money printing. So,
well, there's no doubt that the global economy is far larger today than it would have been if we'd remained on a gold-backed monetary system. It's an allowed total credit in the U.S. has expanded from $1 trillion in 1964 to $66 trillion now. That would not have been possible if we'd remained on a gold-backed monetary system. But, you know, by the way, in terms of who's benefited most, well, I think, for instance, I moved to Asia in 1986. When I was 25. And since that time, Asia has been completely transformed. China has gone from a very poor third world country now into the second largest economy in the world. Shanghai looks like the Emerald City and the Wizard of Oz. And this has all been because of their massive trade surplus with the US, which was $1 trillion last year alone. So the trade surplus countries have benefited and been completely transformed. The world has been transformed by this new arrangement. Hundreds of millions of people have been pulled out of poverty around the world. Now, within the United States, some groups have benefited and others have suffered, or at least not benefited as much. The corporations and the managers of the corporations have their salaries have increased many, many fold. And, of course, the banking industry has benefited from financing so much increase in debt and currency trading and stock trading, et cetera, et cetera. But the middle class in the U.S., okay, they have...
is getting smaller. They're under attack.
It's not all bad. They have iPhones and iPads.
They got a lot more junk in their house, but overall, they don't have the job security.
In terms of their relative standing and their self-worth has suffered because it has been declining relative to the wealthiest segments of society who have benefited enormously.
So on the whole, if you're trying to analyze this, and it's really hard for me to figure out, I dig into all these things and complain all the time, but at the same time, I also say, as all my listeners know, Richard, it's an amazing time to be alive. And, you know, maybe technology will just save us all and solve all our problems. It certainly solves a lot of them. On balance, it's hard to tell if things are better now or worse. You know, I mean, everybody's got, there's just massive consumers, you know, our homes are just full of stuff. And, you know, we've got modern cars and, you know, there's all kinds of surveys that say the poor today are dramatically better off than the poor were, you know, 2 decades ago, 10 decades ago. I don't know. You know, it's hard to figure out.
Yes, well, I think as long as our economy doesn't collapse, I do believe that we still have a big global bubble that has to be kept inflated through government policy of one kind or another. But as long as this bubble continues to remain inflated the way it is now, then we're going to experience technological miracles and marvels unfolding over the next couple of decades that will completely transform everything. But on the other hand, if we were to take the Austrian medicine and allow the bubble to implode as natural forces would have it do, market forces. Well, just let's think what would have happened in 2008 if we had allowed market forces to work. Well, if they had not propped up the banks, then all...
Well, Goldman Sachs would probably be gone, and that would be okay with me.
Well, the Goldman Sachs and every other bank in the world and all the savings that they contained. So all of the savings would have been destroyed. There would have been a political backlash against free trade, so globalization would have broken down, and unemployment would have shot up to 25%, as it did during the Depression.
And so, but many people would argue that in real unemployment, it was 25%. Like, I had ShadowStats founder John Williams on the show, and he made a pretty good argument for that. But, yeah, go ahead.
So government tax revenues would have collapsed by about 50%. So they would no longer have been able to pay Social Security or Medicare or maintain the U.S. military bases around the world. So the old people would end up eating cat food again, as they did in the Depression. The U.S. police force around the world would have to come home, and so we'd be back in a world of chaos. And it would all probably end up in general global chaos, possibly starvation, and probably war.
That doesn't sound good.
So it wouldn't have been just, you know, let's take our medicine and everything will be okay in a couple of years. We'll be back in some sort of laissez-faire Garden of Eden. It wouldn't be like that at all.
I love it.
It would have been such a severe crisis.
It would have been really ugly.
That our civilization might not have survived. And so the policy response that they have carried out has worked miraculously because it's prevented that from happening. Now, it still could. It's all of that. All of those horrible things could still happen. But it, as far as I'm concerned, it's much better if they happen 10 years from now, 20 years, or better yet, 30 or 40 years from now, than if they happen today. Because if they happen today, it's the equivalent of death. There is no deader than dead. It's always better to die tomorrow than die today. So if this is just a matter of kicking the can down the road, then I'm all for it. Kick it hard.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. So, Richard, we've been going long, so we got to wrap it up here fairly soon. And I'm sure you'll agree. You probably got, you know, you got to go hang out in Thailand. But what you said, I think it was you a few years ago when you were on my show, is, you know, right post Great Recession, you were talking about how we should spend $3 trillion. We should spend, you know, I can't remember on what it was, but you will. Maybe $1 trillion on biotech, $1 trillion on infrastructure, and $1 trillion on something else, and that'll make us the world leader in like three fields pretty much instantly in a year or two. Was that you that said that? And how do you feel looking back on that?
Yes. So earlier on, you asked me which economic school I belong to. Am I a Keynesian or... Well, I would describe myself.
You change with the times. I wouldn't say you're an Austrian. That's for sure.
I'm an Austrian heretic.
Okay.
The Austrians were absolutely right in telling us that this sort of credit explosion would ultimately create a world, you know, a massive global bubble, which it did. But where I break with them is in that. I believe this bubble has become so enormously large that if it implodes, it will probably destroy us all. So therefore, we have to analyze our current situation. And I really believe that what we have is a unique moment in history. Printing money is not new. But the combination of printing money with globalization is new.
That is new, yeah.
So one great Austrian economist, Joseph Schumpeter, believed that economic growth was driven by waves of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, automobiles. At another time, chemicals. At one point, railroads.
Well, no, I'm a Schumpeter fan, no question.
Perhaps we need to look at what we've experienced as such a Schumpeter-type innovation, this combination of fiat money with globalization. Fiat money should create inflation, but globalization is so deflationary that it doesn't. So it has allowed an explosion of credit to occur over the last three decades. And when that credit bubble started to pop, the policymakers were able to reflate it by creating even more credit and even more paper money. And it's, this explosion of credit has been the thing that has been driving economic growth for the last 30 years or more. So what should we do?
Well, hang on. Before you tell us what we should do, I'll let you close with that. But let me just throw in a comment here that you might want to, you know, comment on. And that is that I think you're right. Of course, money printing is definitely not new. We all know the stories of that and how it all has always ended. But it is new when you combine it with globalization. Absolutely true. And that's a change. But eventually, don't you ultimately cause the wages, and, you know, it's gone in that direction, but it's still got a long way to go, to start to equalize in, say, China or Mexico versus the U.S.? I mean, they're going in that direction, although admittedly, there's still a giant gap. And when you cause those wages to equalize, when they start equalizing, then you look for other labor markets. And there's certainly been a lot of talk about Africa, but Africa's a disaster. So what's the next cheap labor market you exploit to not have fiat money come home to roost, right? Is that a fair statement?
Sure, it's a fair question. But the thing is, there are 200 or 300 million people in India who would like to work for $5 a day. So we have generations of cheap, ultra-cheap labor in front of us. We have generations before wage rates are going to equalize or even begin to equalize. So this is not something that's going to prevent us from doing what we're doing now anytime soon.
It's a long ways away.
As long as globalization doesn't break down, as long as we don't put up trade barriers, which our president promised to do during his election campaign.
Yes, he did.
But as long as he doesn't, and he seems to have backed off from that at the moment, then we're never going to run out of cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
Not for generations. So this can continue. So we need to, when I say we need to look at all of the theories and economists from the past and apply them to our world and our reality. Well, in our reality, what we have seen over the last, 9 years now, is that it is, in fact, possible for the U.S. government to borrow and spend trillions of dollars that it doesn't have to stimulate the economy and to finance much of that with paper money creation. That's just the fact. That's what we have done. And so, yes, the government debt has doubled to 110% of GDP, half the level of Japan's. So we have to understand the government is going to have these very large budget deficits for years into the future anyway. The question is how are they going to spend this money? Are they going to continue to spend it wastefully on unnecessary wars and too much consumption? Or how about this? Let's have a better plan. The government could invest in new industries and technologies in order to restructure the economy and grow our way out of that, way out of this crisis. So, for instance, over the next 10 years, the government could invest $1 trillion in solar energy and $1 trillion in nanotech and $1 trillion in biotech and $1 trillion in genetic engineering, just for example. And they could do this in two different ways. They could do it the way that they did with NASA under one big roof somewhere where the government manages everything. That worked out pretty well. And not only did we send a man to the moon, but it also greatly enhanced U.S. intercontinental ballistic missile capabilities and bankrupted the Soviet Union. So that wasn't a failure. But perhaps a more sensible way to do this would be the government could act as a giant venture capital funding corporation. The government could borrow the money, and the Fed could finance part of it by printing money. And it could fund, the government could set up joint venture companies with, let's say, the 10,000 most promising U.S. entrepreneurs, Elon Musk, and set up joint venture companies with them. The government provides the funding in exchange for a 60% equity stake for the government, and the 40% is with the management, and the management controls the company. And when one of these companies, lavishly funded, when one of these companies invents a cure for cancer, then they could list that company on NASDAQ for $10 trillion, $6 trillion going to the government, U.S. taxpayers. In other words, these sorts of investments could pay themselves off very quickly and probably pay off the entire national debt. Meanwhile, instead of wasting all of the government money that's going to be spent anyway, foolishly, on unnecessary wars, we could end up inducing a new technological revolution through sensible government investment in new industries and new technologies that would completely restructure the economy, retrain the American workforce so that they would stop pining for their industrial jobs, which are never coming back, and instead be educated at a postgraduate level, at least their children and grandchildren, so that they could contribute at the highest level to technological advances and to economic growth. And that way, we could grow our way out of this crisis. We would never have to take the Austrian medicine of collapsing into a new Great Depression. And we could lock in another American century, and which would benefit not only the U.S., but the world.
Yeah, I think that is a pretty exciting plan. And you know what? This is an interesting way. You have a very interesting way of looking at things. And I have to say, you move the needle on my sort of philosophical bent of take the Austrian medicine, you know. So, Richard Duncan, thank you very much. It's always fascinating to talk to you. Give out your website once more, and Listeners should go and check out the video on the front page of your site. What is that site again?
Yeah, great. So yes, I would just encourage everyone to be open-minded and not too dogmatic, and really keep an open mind about how different our world is than it has been in the past. Things keep changing, and the Austrian solution of, you know, we've sinned, therefore we must go to hell, is not necessarily right. We can find new solutions to new problems in our new environment. So I primarily don't discuss these sort of philosophical issues on my website. I'm more focused on how government policy is driving credit growth and asset prices and what that means for individuals and the financial markets. And so, yes, I would encourage your listeners to visit my website. It's richardduncaneconomics.com. And if you go there, you can sign up for my free blog, or you can subscribe to my video newsletter, MacroWatch. Every couple of weeks, I upload a new video, which is more or less me discussing things like we've been discussing.
Fantastic.
Subscribers to MacroWatch have access to 36 hours now of my MacroWatch videos. So they can subscribe with a 50% discount if they hit the subscribe now button and use the discount coupon code GLOBAL. I hope you'll check it out.
Fantastic. Richard Duncan, thank you so much for joining us.
Jason, my pleasure. Always nice talking with you. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.